Right, so welcome to part four of Blake ahead of his time, ahead of ours. And speaking of being ahead of time, I am going to try this time, as always, unfortunately, because it's term time, at about 6:30 I have to make an exit because I'm due in college at 7. But I will try and curb myself a bit and leave, you know, 10 or 15 minutes at the end just for some response, not only today to today, but more widely, just to have a bit of question and answer and response. So somebody needs to sit on me at about 6:15 or so. So we looked first at an overview of Blake's context and biography. We looked in detail at the Songs of Innocence and Experience and saw that kind of meeting of beauty and anger, actually righteous anger at the abuses of the church, but extraordinary insight into the presence of the divine in the outcast, and particularly in the helpless and in the child, and those visions of the angels looking after the chimney sweeps and so on. But I didn't backpedal on how clearly Blake denounced the complicity of established Christianity with the worst kind of oppression, and how he pointed to the errors and the historical things that had led to that. But I said then that some people had therefore almost set up Blake as a sort of anti-Christian figure, as a kind of, somebody who could be used almost in the various 20th century revivals as a sort of blunt instrument to kind of bash Christians with. And that's why I did last week on Blake and Jesus, just showing how central and how important the figure of Christ was for Blake, but also how challenging. Now I want to talk about Blake as prophet. I'll touch briefly on one of the verses in Songs of Innocence and Experience, but I'll largely be focusing on the great, but it has to be said, little read prophetic poem, Jerusalem, which is not the little lovely lyric, powerful as that is, that we sing. That's a little poem at the front of another poem called Milton. So if I want to talk about Blake as a prophet, I want to say, first of all, that I understand the word prophecy, or what a prophet does, in a twofold sense. That prophecy, I think, is both about speaking out in the present and, as it were, taking away the veils and revealing the inner truths of how things actually are for us now. That is one of the meanings, as it were, of revelation. Prophecy is not always, or even primarily, about prediction of the future. It's about revelation. If you look in, obviously, the Locus Classicus for this, and clearly hugely influential book for Blake, if you look at the book of Revelations, or the revelation of John the Divine, you often see these extraordinary, powerful kind of mythical beings, like, you know, the woman who's clothed with the sun, or the beast with the dragon with seven heads rising out of the sea. And these are revelations of the inner spiritual nature of the conflict that was going on between the Roman Empire and the Christian Church. And it's a kind of taking away of, if you like, the film of familiarity and the ordinary, and the way we compromise with things and say, oh, well, it's just a historical process. I had to compromise. I had to do my bit for the state. You know, ultimately, it's pulling aside the veil and saying, here is the confrontation between good and evil, and this is what it looks like. So that's one aspect of prophecy. And, of course, you see that in the Old Testament prophets all the time. Of course, there is beautiful oracle and prophecy from Isaiah, looking forward through the suffering servant to the coming of Christ. But, there is also simply God saying, you know, I'm fed up to the back teeth with your solemn fasts. If I was hungry, I wouldn't tell you. Do you think I want to hear your beating your breasts and wailing again and fasting and pouring ashes on yourself? This is the kind of fast I want. I want you to feed the hungry. You know, I want you to do justice and love mercy. That's a tradition within the prophetic voice, as it were. So that is one aspect of prophecy, revelation of the true state of affairs as things are now. But it is also, and perhaps because it is a revelation of the way things are now, it is also, we're speaking into the future, articulating a vision that helps to reorient us. Because if we're lost and confused in a fog and we're asleep, if we're sleepwalking, hardly noticing the true spiritual state of affairs in ourselves or in our society, and not having any vision, without vision, the people perish, then we're not exactly going to be able to make sensible plans about how to engage with then meet the future as it comes towards us. So actually, there's two aspects of prophecy: awaking, opening eyes, showing things. Now, naturally leads on to a vision. And of course, there's a deep, deep tradition in the Bible, which of course Blake knew back to front, and the Bible is always Blake's primary source. Lots of great work has been done on the various esoteric and occult sources of Blake's writing, and that's great. You know, I've already mentioned myself, Jakob Burma and Emanuel Swedenborg, among others. Paracelsus is another. But if you haven't read Ezekiel or the Book of Revelation, you don't know where Blake is coming from. It's that's the kind of the language and the way things go. And you will know, if you look at the Old Testament prophets or at the Book of Revelation, that right at the bedrock of that prophecy is hope. That the prophets often speak when Jerusalem, the heaven, the holy city, is invisible to the eyes of the flesh. When Jerusalem is imprisoned in Babylon, it's just, you know, when the children of Israel are in exile in Babylon, that you get, you know, Jeremiah giving a great prophecy about how things will be, and Isaiah prophesying a return. And in the midst of the terrible struggles of persecution and violence, out of which the revelation of John the Divine arose, there is a vision of the heavenly Jerusalem. I saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven adorned as a bride. He doesn't flinch or turn his eyes back from the terrors with which we deal every day in our spiritual struggle. But he lets you see not only that death is not the end for us, that there is, as it were, an Easter and a resurrection, but he also lets you see that that prayer, "Thy kingdom come on earth, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," that is not prayed in vain. And that the one who makes both heaven and earth wants to bring heaven and earth together, and transfigure the one through the other. And as Isaiah says, the earth will be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. So there is always both, if you like, in the future made of prophecy, there's often, as it were, short or middle term prevision of events, like the return of Israel, for example, out of Babylon. But of course, when you read that in Isaiah, it's got a much bigger scope. It turns out to be not just about building a physical city back in the place where the city had been destroyed. It turns out to be something cosmic. And you just have to sing the Messiah to see that. So I want to place Blake as a prophet firmly in that tradition, opening up the eyes, showing both a little bit into the future, but also reminding us finally of the cosmic vision of the coming of peace, of what we might mean by the new Jerusalem. Okay, and I say I want to place Blake like that. This isn't me deciding after the event or anybody else saying, "Ooh, he's a bit of a prophet, Blake." Funny, I wonder if he ever realised that. Blake's own self-identity is entirely taken up with that. So I've given you on the sheets just a couple of things which are both prefaces to significant book. One is from the introduction to the Songs of Experience, and the other is from his own preface to Jerusalem, the long poem. So, Songs of Experience. "Hear the voice of the bard, who present, past, and future sees, whose ears have heard the holy word that walked among the ancient trees." It's extraordinary. He leaves you to think how ancient those ancient trees are. He's certainly thinking about Britain before the coming of its industrial society, and he's thinking about Joseph of Arimathea coming in the lifetime of Christ. But he's obviously thinking much further back than that. He's thinking about the trees in Eden. He's thinking about when we had clarity, when we walked with God in the cool of the evening and heard the voice among the ancient trees. And one of his key ideas is that Edenic experience is still somewhere inside us. And in the spiritual architecture of London / Jerusalem, in the poem Jerusalem, there's one, he describes many gates and walls, and there's a great deal of stuff about opening doors and going in through doors. Let me just show you a fabulous picture. I'll mark it. These are the two frontispiece plates to the poem Jerusalem we're going to be looking at. This figure going through, holding a lantern, opening a door, taking him into new things. And then this extraordinary, beautiful, flowing, organic picture, which is the title plate. Jerusalem, or the emanation of the giant Albion. So there are all these doors and gates, but the one facing Eden, even in the most beautiful parts of the poem, is closed. He's saying there is still a door to be opened, and that's the door of the restoration, which he believes comes in Christ, of the fullness of our humanity and God in our humanity, which will restore that time when we too, as it were, will suddenly find ourselves walking among the ancient trees. So there's a little bit from the preface to the Songs of Experience. Now here's the preface to Jerusalem. What does he think he's doing when he writes this extraordinary poem? Trembling, I sit day and night. My friends are astonished at me. Yet they forgive my, they were astonished at him. Yet they forgive my wanderings. I rest not from my great task to open the eternal worlds, to open the immortal eyes of man, inwards, into the worlds of thought, into eternity, ever expanding in the bosom of God, the human imagination. O Saviour, pour upon me thy spirit of meekness and love. Annihilate the selfhood in me. Be thou all my life. A clear invocation of Christ to help him with this poem. But I just want to draw your attention to two very Blakean features. Our natural instinct, if we want to use big things, huge, enormous, cosmic terms like eternal worlds, eternity, immortal, worlds of thought, time and eternity, our natural movement of the imagination is outwards into what we're now taught to think of as a cold void of space. Somehow, some infinite distance, that's where eternity and infinity are. What does Blake use? Blake says, to open the eternal world, to open the immortal eyes of man inwards. Blake is saying there is as much infinity and eternity, and as much of the presence and the bosom of God open to you from within as from without. You need to kind of almost reverse your inness and outness. So opening eyes, but opening eyes inwards. And yet inwards, inside that, is something which is ever expanding. That's a wonderful idea, ever expanding in the bosom of God. You know, this is almost a kind of, you know, expanding cosmos, but the expanding cosmos of God's loving presence can be in. It's a pretty extraordinary thing. Now, how is he going to do it? Well, Christ is going to help him to do this opening of the eyes. And this is another thing I just want to really emphasize. Annihilate the selfhood in me. Be thou all my life. There's a very clear thing in Blake about the need, as it were, to set self or ego aside, about the need for some kind of turning and repentance. And as we'll see in the poem we're really going to look at, Jerusalem, it's all about how Albion, the giant Albion, who, as Albion, of course, represents, in one sense, represents England, the beloved land, England's green and pleasant land. It represents the whole of the nation. But actually, in the bigger symbolism of the poem, Albion is every person. Albion is the whole of humanity, but the humanity considered all together. And in the poem, Albion has fallen into sleep, and from into sleep, into bondage. He's become chained. He's kind of sleeping on a rock, having bad dreams. And his bad dreams are the bad side of the history of England, among other things. They're the dreams of conquest. They're the dreams of crushing the opposition. They're the dreams of territorial conquest and building empire. They're the dreams, ultimately, of only being saved by power. And he's forgotten, as it were, in that sleep, what Blake somewhere else calls Newton's sleep. He's forgotten who he really is, and he needs to wake up. Blake got there before James Joyce and Stephen Dedalus's famous remark, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake. That's pretty much a good plot summary of Jerusalem. So Blake wants to open your eyes. He wants to open his own eyes. He believes Christ can allow him to do that. So we open our eyes. What do we see? If we're to see with Blake's prophetic vision, what does Blake see? Well, I've given you a couple of little bits before we head on into Jerusalem. The poem he wrote before Jerusalem was a poem called Milton, and I've just given you a couple of little bits. I haven't got time now to go into the weird and wonderful plot of Milton, which largely consists of the poet Milton descending down from heaven to say, you guys have completely misunderstood my poem. And he goes back into Albion and sort of rewrites it. This is Milton speaking to the sleeping Albion, trying to reorient his vision. And here's a couple of bits. Seest thou the little winged fly, smaller than a grain of sand? It has a heart like thee, a brain open to heaven and hell. Within side wondrous and expansive, its gates are not closed. I hope thine are not. Hence it clothes itself in rich array. Hence thou art clothed with human beauty, O thou mortal man. Extraordinary. It's infinities within. And then, in another passage, it's very interesting, he addresses the beginnings of the scientific and technical revolution. He talks a lot about the technical and industrial developments, and he looks at the way we believe that by having instruments like microscopes and telescopes, we're getting a better picture of total reality. And he says, wait a minute, think about this. So this is what he says. The microscope knows not of this vision, nor the telescope. They alter the ratio of the spectator's organs, but leave objects untouched. For every space larger than a red globule of man's blood is visionary and is created by the hammer of loss. Loss is the embodiment of the creative or artistic spirit, the imagination at work in the making and shaping of art and beauty in this poem, and is visionary and is created by the hammer of loss. And every space smaller than a globule of man's blood opens into eternity, of which this vegetable earth is but a shadow. The red globule is the unwearied sun by loss created. It's fairly mind-blowing stuff. Now, there's a really interesting thing going on here. On the one hand, he's saying, don't think that by having a mechanical instrument with which to examine the surfaces of your constructed, purely material, mechanical universe, you're going to enlarge your vision. All you're doing is changing the ratio of what you see. You need another kind of vision. You need to look through as well as with, through as well as at, okay? On the other hand, though, have you noticed that he's taken the imaginative possibilities given to us by the telescope and the microscope and used them as metaphors for spiritual vision? So he actually talks about suns and distant worlds, and he talks about tiny globules of blood, and clearly somebody has shown him both through a microscope and a telescope, and he's saying, now these could be images of spiritual vision if you'll let them be. In fact, he's done that thing that I can remember doing as a little kid, and we probably all did it, where after you've learnt somewhere in a science lesson in primary school about the solar system and the planets going round, somebody then teaches you about the atom, don't they? And they say, oh, well, there's a nucleus and there's the electrons going round and round, you know, and they're all then together, and you're told they'll get together in molecules. And somebody else, meantime, is telling you about the stars going together in galaxies. And you're bound at some point, aren't you, to go, whoa, that's interesting. It's just a matter of scale, isn't it? You know, if I was a quark, you know, then obviously the atom would be an amazing cosmic event for me. You know, there's a sense in which the creation of these instruments which alter scale suddenly give us a freedom to think about vastnesses within and without. So that's just a little bit from Milton. Now I want to use the time I've got to get into this longer poem, Jerusalem, which, as I said, tells the story of Albion's deadly sleep, of how Albion's bride, or emanation as he calls him, Jerusalem, is separated from him. Albion loses the vision of who he is and loses the vision of who Jerusalem is, and she's taken away from him, and various sort of evils and corruptions come and separate them. And eventually, at the end of the poem, they're reunited, but only because he is able at last to see through the false versions. And he's helped to do it. There are various characters whom William Blake calls the Eternals, who come onto the scene to help Albion or to hinder him. And the one called Loss represents the spirit of poetry, the grasping of things by imagination, by apprehension, the power to use symbol and metaphor. Those things aren't to do with poetry and art. And it is Loss who finally rescues Albion from his cold repose, he's fallen into a view that only what he can see with his eye and measure with his dividers and manipulate with his hand is real. So, of course, he doesn't see who he is or anything else. He loses his vision. And the poem is about the loss and then the restoration of vision. Okay, so just a broad picture. And what does Blake see? One of the things he says in the poem quite early is he sees abstract philosophy warring in enmity against imagination, which is the divine body of the Lord Jesus, blessed forever. So he sees the development in his own day of Enlightenment philosophical thinking, which was a real drive for complete rationalism, for a totally rational and preferably mathematical explanation of everything, and as far as possible for a rational, you know, material account of everything. And Blake is not saying that the discoveries of science in themselves and under their own terms are necessarily false. He's simply saying they're just one level vision. And compared with total awakening spiritual awareness of all things, as well as with, in which matter is one of the all things you're aware of, just to have that one level vision is to be asleep, that's what he's saying, and is to be in a kind of bondage. So what else does he see? He says, I see the fourfold man, the humanity, that's Albion, but it's all of us, in a deadly sleep, and its fallen emanation. The spectre, its cruel shadow. So what happens is, in the sleep of his true spiritual being, Albion's little ego wakes up and runs around as his spectre, doing all kinds of damage and as a shadow and projection of him, because he no longer realizes spiritually who he is. So he compensates for the vacuity in himself by acquiring and by affirming himself through oppression of others. So one of the things that Blake saw as being particularly horrible about what had happened to Christianity is that he believed that Christianity should awaken each person to the infinite value, not only of themselves, but of every other person they meet, because Christ is in them and Christ is in the other. And that therefore the whole need to big yourself up and say, well, I need to oppress you in order to become wealthy, because then when I become wealthy, I'll have some sense of who I really am, and, you know, people will respect me because I've got a Rolls Royce or whatever. That entire way of thinking, and that projected on a nation, we want to be top nation, that entire system of competitiveness and of valuing the quote-unquote success of the person who has the most material things, he sees as an entire loss of vision and as a hideous attempt to compensate for having lost the inner Christ and the inner vision. And what he thought was the grossest of all possible things was that the church had simply gone along with it and blessed it and given it religious respectability. That's what made him so angry. So the spectre, its cruel shadow. I see the past, present and future existing all at once. Before me, O divine spirit, all at once before me. O divine spirit, sustain me on my wings, that I may awake Albion from his long and cold repose, from Bacon and Newton, sheathed in dismal steel, their terrors hang like iron scourges over Albion. Reasonings, like vast serpents, enfold around my limbs, bruising my minute articulations. Isn't that a wonderful idea that you're trying to actually articulate something? But we are all victims of the spirit of our age. And the cold sleep of Newton, the basic assumption that material reality is the objective true thing and spiritual reality is just some funny little thing we've made up for ourselves that doesn't really correspond to ultimate reality, that presumption sort of casts a shadow over everything we do. And that's what he's trying to shake off. So what is the source of that presumption? Why has it become almost impossible for someone in the 18th century, as he was, let alone then the 19th century, he's writing this actually at the beginning of the 19th century, started the poem in 1804, didn't finish it till 1820, so it was a big work for him. what is it that had meant that somebody in that period couldn't have the kind of visions that, say, somebody like St. Francis could have quite easily? Why is it that we didn't have this sense of the translucence of the world that seemed to be available, not only to ourselves in the past, but is still available, or seemed to be still available to, often to other cultures and other faiths? What is it that had closed our eyes? Well, as far as he was concerned, the basic answer was bad things in Oxford and Cambridge. Not quite, but here's what he says. These are the dark satanic mills as well as the factories. I turn my eyes to the schools and universities of Europe, and there behold the loom of Locke. Locke, a philosopher who, among other things, was trying to work out how we can account for human consciousness and reasoning by a series of material connections and associations, which were in their own way modelled on what Newton had done by substituting gravity for love. You know, that the system of the idea that the heavenly bodies move and that something must be moving them was obviously a very old idea, and that each movement must be related to another was clearly an old idea. I mean, Newton didn't invent that. But the previous theory, which was most beautifully expressed by Dante, was he's talked about l'amour che muove, you know, the love that moves the sun and the other stars. They believed that God was, as it were, in love turning things, and each thing was turned, and that we longed for heaven because we loved it, and we naturally fly upwards to it, and that the earth loves the rest of the earth and likes to fall down into it. So there's a kind of, the word move, we still have an echo of this old vision that we used to have when we say, I was very moved by that. There was a time when motion and emotion had the same spiritual root, and you didn't think of motion, the motion of heavenly bodies, as kind of value-free. Okay? But why have we lost that? Well, he says it's because of the schools and universities of Europe, and it's because this essentially, although it was nominally deist, actually essentially material atheist view. The loom of Locke, whose woof rages die, washed by the water wheels of Newton, black the cloth in heavy wreaths, folds over every nation. It's like they put this big blanket that is kind of crushing the spiritual vision of everybody. Black the cloth in heavy wreaths, folds over every nation. Cruel, now this is really powerful, cruel works of many wheels I view. Wheel without wheel, with cogs tyrannic, moved by compulsion each other, not as those in Eden, which wheel within wheel, in freedom revolve in harmony and peace. Now that vision, that contradistinction between the motion which is forced by a kind of mechanical action and reaction, and literally the image of the cog, the idea of the cog as tyrannic, but you know, you're turned as a wheel in a cog because some other wheel is turning. That is, you know, a really good image of material determinism. But it is also, of course, an image of clockwork, and an image also of those machineries for changing motion, which were beginning to be done in factories. And Blake saw a process whereby we had constructed a machine where we could have a mechanical, just wind it up and let it run. And then we had fallen down and worshipped our own idol, and we'd reconfigured the whole cosmos according to our little machine and said, oh, look, I've made a piece of clockwork. It just keeps going and one bit moves another. Cool, the cosmos must be like that. I mean, you know, and now I'm going to, you know, if you don't think we do this, you think about the extraordinary mystery of the human mind and human consciousness and how now we take one of the trashiest little machines that we've ever invented, which is, you know, personal computers. And we now talk about our being hardwired for things. We talk about our software. We talk about our memory banks. We talk about delete buttons. We're starting to do things to people in prisons and schools based on the model that a person is a thing that can be reprogrammed. We have completely diminished our own humanity by making ourselves in the image of a thing that we could make. So we now become less than the thing of our hands, rather than saying whatever made this is greater than this. Yeah? Well, as we're doing that now to ourselves, Blake saw that we'd done that to the whole cosmos, okay? But he saw more than that. He saw that the actual construction mentally of a picture of the world in which each thing is forced to move by another thing and nothing actually finally has a choice, but we're just cogs, you know, it's a big machine. And then the realization that we ourselves are cogs in the machine. Then we have a problem about consciousness, so we call it the ghost in the machine, but the machine has become primary. He saw that leading directly to the other social ills and oppressions of a machine age. He saw the beginning of industrialization. He saw how people were being turned into cogs in machines and how that would become socially acceptable because we all accepted a picture in the end that was based around the machine. amazingly, when he moved across the river to Lambeth from where he'd been, and well, I first sort of did my little bit of biography, he was working there, and the first factory in London was built pretty much four doors down from Blake's house, and I kid you not, it was called Albion Mills. It really was called Albion Mills. And next to it was also the place which we talked about in one of my other talks, where the also with spinning wheels and machines, these girls from off the street were being put to work. And so he actually, you know, everything he felt about Albion, and there it was, Albion Mills. So the word tyrannic is really important. It's not simply that he's saying the machine is a metaphor for the way we mistreat each other. He's saying we mistreat each other because we've actually allowed the machine to become a metaphor for both the cosmos and the person. And he says, if you want wheels, look at wheels the other way. And he's thinking about Ezekiel's wheels and the angels of wheels and the wheels of eyes and the sense of, you know. But again, it's the difference of move from within to being compelled from without. Okay? So, there is a really extraordinary... Why should punishment weave the veil with iron wheels of war, when forgiveness might it weave with wings of the cherubim? Okay. When I was preparing this, I was just kind of looking through these great passages again, and I suddenly remembered this extraordinary conversation between Treebeard and Saruman, or Treebeard and Gandalf about Saruman, where Treebeard says he has a mind of metal and wheels, you know. And this whole thing actually is dramatized in a beautiful way by another prophetic imaginative writer, Tolkien. And I think if you look at the whole difference between Gandalf's approach and Saruman's approach, you'll get a picture of some of what Blake is going on about, actually. And in fact, a lot of what Blake says about imagination is also picked up by another of the Inklings, Owen Barfield, who was, of course, a friend and influencer of Tolkien. And at some stage, you know, God willing and the people consenting, I will try and write a little bit about those links, how this Blakean vision finds its way into the Inklings. So, that's...
You could do us a talk on Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Oh, I need to get some people here who could help me out with that. Susanna over there. Yeah, that's a thought. Okay, so that's the bit I want to say about his vision of where we are now. And even though it was his vision of his own time, I think we can all recognise how pertinent it is to ours, and how the argument about who we really are and what the cosmos is really like. Can we still challenge the terms of argument? Are we ultimately still reductive materialists who think that in the end, it's just the interaction, action and reaction of billiard balls on the cosmic table, as it were, which we then mistake for thought and art and beauty and soul, but it's just, that's just an epiphenomenon of the unwinding of enzymes. Do we want to say that? Or do we want to say, hey, look at these enzymes, they're amazing, there's a whole cosmos inside each one of them, and you know, all of these are the outer layers of the inwardness of our spiritual being, and perhaps the spiritual being of the cosmos that's unfolding around us. There's an amazing bit, which I haven't given you, where he anticipates, wonderful, Newton would have absolutely loved quantum theory. He would have been fascinated by current cosmology, particularly because of the both-and-ness of it and the kind of saying that you can't... And there's a bit where he says, Newton's particles of light are waves upon the Red Sea shore. Yeah, and she goes, oh, particles, waves, they're both. It's amazing. Blake got there first. Anyway... I want, in the final time that's here to me, to look a little bit about that second sense of prophecy and see how this great poem, Jerusalem, which he intended to be a wake-up call, literally, as well as metaphorically, but which he also wanted to give us hope. In his view, we were in the darkest days, and he was pretty right, and it got worse. Kathy was talking to me last time when I'd done the session on Songs of Innocence and Experience, and I was saying, look at how amazing how easily he feels about what the black child and the mother of the black child under the tree has to teach, and how he will help the English child to bear the rays, and I was saying, you know, that's not... And she was pointing out that actually, at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, there was a certain amount of spiritual openness and that actually a narrowing down and an arrogant assumption that we are the people who really know and that our material culture is the only and best culture really developed after that. And it's the kind of mid-Victorian period, which is even more repressive than the period that Blake was writing in. So things got worse before they got better. And when they were getting worse, nobody was reading Blake at all. He was just completely misunderstood. But late in the 19th century and then through into the 20th century, people began to pick up. So I want to just look at the overarching story of Jerusalem and see whether we can map where we might be and whether we can look a little bit into what is coming along the horizon for us as we move perhaps into an age which is going to be more integrated, which is going to have imagination brought back into our understanding of how the world is, in which there seems to be very widespreadly now an awakening of spirituality. There's no question that the Marxist materialist prediction that religion would wither on the vine and that we would be satisfied by material kind of things have not come true. People no longer. I'm glad that anthropologists no longer use the term folk religion, but what they do use is a very useful term, which is common spirituality. There's a kind of undercurrent of that. And so let's see where we are. This is the story. Albion, I'm going to take you to three key moments in Jerusalem. The first is right near the opening where we're introduced to the sleeping Albion and Christ tells Blake, go and wake up Albion. Okay? So, and these are the words that Christ gives to Blake to speak to Albion, which is all of us. Awake, awake, O sleeper in the land of shadows. Wake, expand. And the I here is Christ, not Blake. I am in you, and you in me. Mutual in love divine. Fibers of love to love. Fibers of love from man to man through Albion's pleasant land. It's like Jesus standing by the woman with the well saying, if only you knew who you really are and who I am, the fountain would well up within you. Huh? But Albion doesn't get it. Here is Albion's response. Albion, I put here as a summary, turns away into darkness, denying the divine reality. And this is what he says. But the perturbed man away turns down the valleys dark. Phantom, this is Albion replying to Christ, basically saying, I don't believe in you. Phantom of the overheated brain. See the material account there? This is Dawkins before his time. You know, you're just another meme. Now get lost, you know. Phantom of the overheated brain, shadow of immortality, seeking to keep my soul a victim to thy love. Golly, fall things over. Seeking to keep my soul. That'd be interesting for the people living on the listening to the podcast. Seeking to keep my soul a victim to thy love, which binds man, the enemy of man, into deceitful friendships. And then Jerusalem, remember, is both his bride in the story, but also is the vision of how things really should be, the heavenly city, right? Jerusalem is not. Her daughters are indefinite. The daughters of Jerusalem are all the good things that we might aspire to. So, that's just wishy-washy, subjective stuff. Her daughters are indefinite. Then this is the new creed of the new Albion. This is the creed of Albion Mills. This is the creed of rational, materialist, Newtonian, Lockean, Dawkinsian England. By demonstration, man alone can live, and not by faith. And what does that lead to? Oh, that's good. If God's not around and I don't have to notice that everybody is in every... I can stop possessing things and grabbing them and exploiting them and ruining them. That'll be good. My mountains are my own and I will keep them to myself. The Malvern and the Cheviot, the Wolds, Plinlimlion and Snowdon are mine. Here I will build my laws of moral virtue. Humanity shall be no more but war and princedom and victory. So that's what Albion is becoming. So Albion turns aside, he's separated from Jerusalem, who then is imprisoned within Babylon, which turns out to be in the workhouses of London. That's the passage I gave you the other week. And that's perhaps where England was when Blake was writing. But it's not the end of the story, you'll be relieved to hear. Here's what happens next. Albion eventually, thanks to poetry and art, because he's given up on religion, thanks to the works of Loss, the poet and artist, begins to realise that the material thing cannot be the total picture. And he also sees that the thing he's chosen is actually meaningless and pointless. There's no, because there's no spiritual person, what's the point of having all this stuff anyway? This is the way it's put. This is Albion. Oh, what is life? And what is man? Oh, what is death? Wherefore are you, my children, natives in the grave to where I go? Or are you born to feed the hungry ravenings of destruction, to be the sport of accident? That's the final bleakness, isn't it? The absurdity of a universe with no spirit or purpose. To waste in wrath and love a weary life in brooding cares and anxious labours that prove but chaff. That's a pretty good description of Big Brother House, really, I think. Then he suddenly remembers Jerusalem and all that the vision of Jerusalem means and building Jerusalem in England's green and present land. And he says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I have forsaken thy courts, thy gates of thanksgiving, thy windows of praise, thy clouds of blessing, thy cherubims of tender mercy, stretching their wings sublime over the little ones of Albion. See, it's all about children. What kind of world am I giving my children, this vision? Oh, then he turns at last to Christ, whom he sees, and there is just this moment, as I'm about to read it, is just stunningly illustrated here. I have marked it. I really have. That's Albion, and that's Christ, who you will see is not on a cross, but on a living tree, on an ancient oak. Okay? O human imagination, O divine body, I have crucified and turned my back upon thee into the wastes of the moral law. There Babylon is builded in the waste, founded in human desolation. So he's come to himself, but he's still stuck in this nightmare of the cog's tyrannic and the ego and the desire driving in the material. So how's he going to get out of it? Well, loss brings Jerusalem back to him. And then the Holy Spirit comes, the divine breath. Now I think we're looking to Blake's vision of what a spiritual revelation for Albion might be. The breath divine went forth upon the morning hills. This is so beautiful, this passage. It's a real creation poetry. The breath divine went forth upon the morning hills. Albion moved upon the rock. He opened his eyelids in pain. In pain he moved his stony members. He saw England. Ah, and shall the dead live again? The breath divine went forth over the morning hills. Albion rose. Thou seest the sun in heavy clouds struggling to rise above the mountain. In his burning hand he takes his bow, then chooses out his arrows of flaming gold. Murmuring, the bowstring breathes with ardour. Clouds roll on around the horns of the wide bow. Loud-sounding winds sport on the mountain brows. It's beginning to... Because he kept the divine vision in time of trouble. Somebody kept it going. The Blakes of this world did not cease from mental fight, waiting for this day to come. Because... as the sun and moon lead forward the visions of heaven and earth, England, who is Britannia, entered Albion's bosom, rejoicing. Then Jesus appeared, standing by Albion as the good shepherd by the lost sheep that he hath found. And Albion knew that it was the Lord. That's a great reference to, you know, resurrection appearances, isn't it? And Albion knew that it was the Lord. But what does he call him? This is a wake-up call for the narrowest of the Christians. He knew that it was the Lord, the universal humanity. And Albion saw his form, a man. And they conversed as man with man in ages of eternity. And the divine appearance was the likeness and similitude of Los. That's Los, the poet, the artist. Now, if you've got any issues about Jesus as the universal humanity, go back to 1 Corinthians 15 and think about, as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Albion said, O Lord, what can I do? My selfhood cruel marches against thee, deceitful, from Sinai and from Edom into the wilderness of Judah to meet thee in his pride. I behold the visions of my deadly sleep of 6,000 years, dazzling round thy skirts like a serpent of precious stones and gold. I know it is myself, O my divine creator and redeemer. So Albion realizes the repentance is, what have I been doing all this time? In my sleep of 6,000 years. Jesus replied, Fear not, Albion. Unless I die, thou canst not live. But if I die, I shall arise again, and thou with me. This is friendship and brotherhood. Without it, man is not. So Jesus spoke, the covering cherub coming on in darkness overshadowed them. And Jesus said, thus do men in eternity, one for another, to put off by forgiveness every sin. Albion replied, cannot man exist without mysterious offering of self for another? Is this friendship and brotherhood I see in the likeness and similitude of lost my friend? Jesus said, this is just amazing, bit of theology coming up now, radical theology. Jesus said, wouldst thou love one who never died for thee, or ever die for one who had not died for thee? And if God dieth not for man, and giveth not himself eternally for man, man could not exist. For man is love, as God is love. Every kindness to another is a little death in the divine image, nor can man exist but by brotherhood. It's an amazing idea that we are given our humanity by a self-giving act of love. And it's only when we get that and receive it and then do the self-giving act of love back that we exist at all. And the boldness with which he takes the statement in John, God is love, and then says, man is love. Because that's what the definition of humanity is. It's not the vegetative world or the corpuscular thing or the cogs tyrannic that we think are going on in our overheated brains. That's interesting stuff, but it's not the heart of what we are. So I'm going to draw stumps there because I said I would. And that's a flavour. It's a taster. You notice several times he repeated the phrase ever-expanding. It is literally mind-expanding. I'm of the generation for whom the word psychedelic is a good word. And, of course, psychedelic simply means soul-expanding. That's what it means. And this is more psychedelic, believe me, than anything, you know, that anybody could have purchased elsewhere. This is, and much better for you. But really does cleanse the gates of perception. I always think it was one of the deepest ironies, you know, that in the doors of perception, a quotation from Brake, if only we could cleanse the doors of perception, we'd see everything as it is, infinite. You know, Aldous Huxley writes this great essay, The Doors of Perception, which he says, hey, cool, I took mescaline and Blake is right. You know, no. If you take mescaline, you haven't got Blake at all. You are still in that material consumerist cogs. All you're doing is kind of pulling random levers in your mechanic brain and getting a light show. This is about serious spiritual transformation of total vision, and that only comes by the act of love and by the setting aside of the tyrannic self. It's about spiritual renewal. And for Blake, it only happens because God has already done it in you and for you, and because inside here, already totally available to you at every moment, is the ever-expanding love of God. There is no mystery in the heaven of heavens which you can't also find in your own heart, because heaven is in here as well as out there. That's what Blake is saying, which is pretty radical stuff. And, you know, some Christians looked at it and said, oh, you know, that takes away our monopoly. You know, we're trying to say he's up there, and if you come to us, we'll hoist you high enough and, you know, get you up there. So being told it's ever expanding in here, you know. But then he was a radical Christian. He didn't want to see the institutional churches and the priests like me in black gowns walking their rounds. He wanted everybody to be set free, like Albion, to find that breath of the morning and that Christ with me. Anyway, I said I'd stop, so I'm going to do it. Right, that's the end of the four sessions, but if you want to come back to me on any of that, let's do it. What has it meant to you? Have you found or discovered something? Is there something we've totally failed to cover that you want to come in on? Let me know. Quite possibly, yeah. I think he's picking 6,000 years because it's, as it were, the span of biblical history. Because there's a sense in which his Albion is also Adam. I'm not sure that he believed in the 6,000 years. I mean, I don't think he followed Usher. I think it's his cipher for history. I mean, I've missed out a whole huge complication from the story, which is that Albion and Israel, who has 12 sons, obviously, in Blake's cosmic view, are the same person who accidentally gets separated in history. Okay? I thought this was just a bit too good. So the whole biblical thing, and one of the things that Blake gets out of that is, in his view, and this would be controversial, in his view, the reason why the prophets were sent, Isaiah and Ezekiel in particular, was to tell Israel that Israel had got it wrong, and that their belief, which was embodied, if you like, to some degree in the book of Joshua and Leviticus, that yeah, go out and crush the Amalekites, you know, God wants us to destroy everybody, you know, we'll clean the place out and ethnically cleanse it, and then we'll come in, because God, you know, that warlike, we're the only right people and God wants us to kill everybody else. He sees that as a fall of Israel, and he sees the prophets as being sent to turn Israel around and get Israel ready for the coming of Christ, who will redeem Israel. And he sees an exact parallel between the oppressions done against the, as it were, native peoples of the Canaanites, and what he saw Albion, England, doing and beginning to do to the whole rest of the world, including and especially India and Africa. And he saw us as making the same tragic error as he saw it. And he saw that just as, I mean, you know, Blake being modest here, that just as God had sent Ezekiel and Isaiah to wake up Israel to her true vocation and get her ready for the Logos, so he believed that God had sent him, William Blake, to wake up Albion from the same error. So that's why the 6,000 years. And there's loads of stuff where he carefully makes an exact comparison between every one of the 12 tribes of Israel and various characters in contemporary English history, but I just didn't want to go there. Yeah.
Do you think that Blake's prophecy altered, that you may have touched on in your previous lecture about Innocence and Experience, but do you think his prophecy changed between writing Innocence and Experience? Or do you think he's always had the same story?
Well, he certainly wrote Experience after Innocence, that's true. But then he actually, when he wrote the Experience ones, some people think this is just to save the copper, but I don't think so. He deliberately inscribed the Experience ones, the parallel ones, on the back of the same physical copper plate. And when he did the preface to the two together, Songs of Innocence and Experience, he said, showing the two contrary states of the human soul. I think he believed that we are always in both Innocence and Experience, and that's not chronological. So there's an Infant Joy poem, which is all about lovely blossom. And then there's the infant sorrow. You know, my mother groaned, my father wept, into the dangerous world I leapt, helpless, naked, piping loud like a fiend within a cloud, fiend hid in a cloud. You know, and that strange, bound and weary, I thought best to sulk upon my mother's breast. That's close observation of egotistical babies, you know. So I don't think he had this kind of projecting innocence onto one state. And I think he thought somebody in the full-blown glory of their manhood or womanhood enjoying glorious sex was also innocent as well as experienced. So I don't think he, you know, he didn't buy that innocent child experience stroke guilty adult thing at all. I think he thought we are all always innocent and always experienced, and we need to find the way through the contraries of progressing. Anybody else want to throw anything in?
Or I just wanted something that he talks about sin, and if we were without sin, we wouldn't, if we waited to be without sin, we would never enter into the kingdom. He says, I am a sinful person. The idea of self-improvement and getting better and trying to be good. When he's is this what you just said?
Well, I think you may remember I read I think last time his attack on the deists and his thing about tearing the moral law out of the gospel and then just presenting the moral law as though it were the gospel and what terrible damage that does. And I think he thought the whole thing of believing that everybody can self-improve and we can all pull ourselves up to heaven by our bootstraps and we must just be better and better and more successful. He saw that as oppression. He actually had a very strong theology of grace, which depending on admitting your need for love all the time. And that is what's going on in this exchange at the end between Albion and Christ. But Albion still doesn't quite get it. He says, cannot man exist without this mysterious offering of self for another? Can't I still be, you know, this is the classic English thing, you know, it is the, I'll have you know I'm a self-made man, you know, to which the vicar replies, you've relieved God Almighty of a terrible responsibility. But, you know, the fact is that that is a deep temptation. But actually it's an oppression, because in the end we're never as good as we want to be. And then we blame ourselves for not being as good as we want to be. And now, since we've abandoned any notion of moral goodness and we only care about glamour and looks, we now have a terrible thing where people hurt and oppress themselves because they're not the correct physical shape, you know? And they harm themselves or they starve themselves because virtue has now become, you know, slenderness or youth or whatever it's supposed to be. So it's an even more impossible thing that we're telling ourselves we've got to do. And when we don't do it, since we no longer have a kind of grace, we fail. Whereas Blake said, if you start with the idea that we are all absolutely and at all times needing to be rescued by love, but actually we are rescued by love, and at all times and in all places love is there for us, if only we'll let go of our grasping kind of I've got to do it by myself stuff and let love lift us, then we will be lifted by love. Now, having been lifted by love, we'll do stuff. When Albion wakes up, I saw he does go and get his bow of burning gold and says, oh, I'm Albion, wait a minute, I can do, you know. And he's once he's restored by love, he does want to do things, but he's not doing things. He's doing things, as it were, for the sake of the liberation of the other, rather than to actually prove that, you know, he can live by demonstrations. Faith is always gift, I think, for Blake, as vision is always gift. And it's a snare to think, I'll do it by myself, which only leads in the end to a kind of neurosis, really. I think that's what he would say. How would Blake define love? Boy, that's a good question. Well, he talks it there as setting aside the self and being for the other. He also says every act of kindness is a little death. So I don't think he defines love as simply feeling good about someone. I think he's saying, I mean, somebody else, not Blake, wants to define love as taking another person's being and interests at least as seriously as you take your own. Jesus defined it exactly that way. He said, love your neighbour as yourself. Love your God. So love is about actually saying, okay, I am me and that's nice, but I'm only me. What's good about me is that I'm loved, not that I've done stuff, right? And once I know that what's good about me is that I'm loved, which is not something I can earn or deserve or do anything about, it's just a given, suddenly the energy in me, which might have been used in trying to build or prop up my ego and kind of gone up, can suddenly set free to do other stuff. And what is the other stuff I want to do? I want to love somebody else. I want to pass that love on. But I discover very quickly that I can't love somebody else if I keep getting in the way with my neediness. Now, in actual fact, I do keep getting in the way with my neediness all the time, as anybody I have loved will attest. But I keep trying not to, as it were. And the best way to try not to is to be completely absorbed in the other. That's why it's really good for lovers to stare at each other really hard and, you know, look at each other and love positively every surface of every square inch of each other's skin, because that's actually looking, that's about setting the self aside. You see what I mean? So I think love is setting the self aside and entering into and delighting in and working for the well-being of another. Knowing that the others are doing that for you. And you can't do it for yourself at all.
So I wonder whether, you know, when the British at the Last Night of the Proms sing Jerusalem with such amazing fervor, why do you think that is?
Well, why it is, there might be two answers to that. You might want to do an answer psychologically about each person and why they're doing that, and it's good to have corporate singing. But I think there is a spiritual answer. I think, although Blake didn't, you know, he sold like 12 copies of this or whatever, and, you know, now it's coming into its own. At the time, he didn't make an impact. But you could say the quintessence of what he wanted to say is in that little lyric. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my soul, you know, to have built Jerusalem and England's green pleasant land. And that evocation of Christ and the countenance divine, it is the quintessence of Blake in a way. And I think we do sing it because, although I don't think Blake intends his prophecies to be taken literally, that you couldn't take, but I think spiritually they're true. And I think there is something lost in us, there's something about our vocation that we've kind of keep forgetting, and that we are in this cold mute sleep. And I think that song is a wake-up call, and I think something stirs in us. We can't put our finger on it. But that sense of the arrows of desire, that's just brilliant. You know, that's where Blake's theology differs from some of the repressive theology of the Christians around him. He didn't think desire was a bad thing. He thought desire was a good thing. You just have to shoot it in the right direction, you know. And so I think that vision that there is something to be built, something spiritual to be built, and we can all do it mentally together, I think people get that. They may not say it articulate, and they may be thinking, oh, it's the last night of the problems, or, you know, this is the Women's Institute and we're making jam. But somewhere in the music of the proms and in the exchange of jam jars between consenting adults, there is, in fact, a building of love mutually enfolded in one another.
Supranationalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
It isn't just jingoism.
No, it isn't just jingoism, I think. Blake was totally anti-jingo, and yet, in my view, he wrote in Jerusalem a great national poem about the yet-to-happen awakening of the nation. Okay, well, we probably had better draw stumps. Thank you all very much for sort of bearing with me. We've recorded them, you can get them. I am also, I've been asked to see if I can write one in a series of little books about historical figures that are coming out called Pocket Giants. And I am doing the one on Blake. So I'm hoping that we can gather some of this material in printed form. Also, at this point, can I do two shameless plugs? One is Tuesday Talks, this Tuesday 5:30, it's not all, the next ones are going to be a pair done by Fraser Watts in November on the 6th and the 20th. Fraser Watts is my fellow priest here. He's a scientist and a psychologist, a deep understanding of the nature of the human mind and counselling, as well as a profoundly Christian person. And he's going to talk about Christianity and counselling, the view both ways. So the view of Christianity from counselling, the view of counselling. And he's going to do two talks, one each the other. So that's the 6th and the 20th. And also, shameless plug, I have also written recently and finished a sequence of 70 sonnets of trying to pick up this call, you know, that through the imagination we come to things apprehending. Which we've been sort of trialling, as it were, in this church. Most of them have been used here, but they're now being published by Canterbury Press, and they start in Advent, so they start at the beginning of December, and they go right through the year. And we're going to have a launch here in this church on the 5th of December at 7:30, and we'll read from them and play some music and stuff, and they'll be available to buy then. So if you fancy that, that's the 5th of December, and that's just a leaflet produced by the publisher, which is Canterbury Press, so there are a few of those around. Thank you.